Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, ethics. This is the second of two special topics lectures. Now, next week, I will do chapter 12, the last chapter in the textbook. I've extended the deadline for that chapter to the 26th to get the homework done. So you've got plenty of time. And I do that one the last. It sort of ties up the course. But here's the thing, is chapter 12 homework is optional. If you go in and try to do it, it counts. If you don't touch it, it does not count. So that's something to keep in mind. So in other words, if you don't do it, I drop the three lowest of 11 scores. If you do it, I drop the three lowest of 12 scores. So if you try and think you can do it, you can improve your overall, then do it. But if you're afraid that it might get a low, you might get a low score on it, then it'd probably be better to avoid it. But it is definitely optional. So just don't touch it if you don't want to do it. Don't just sample it and see how it is, because then suddenly the score will bind on it. So just keep that in mind. But I will do chapter 12 next week just to tie up the course, and we'll of course have a quiz on Monday of next week. Just the quiz 7. That one will be on NPV and IRR, break even, and a weighted average cost of capital problem. Here we go. The lecture today is on ethics, and there is a supporting PowerPoint presentation slide deck to go with part of this lecture, the part that has to do with what's called the agency dilemma. So that will help you, because there's a lot of terminology in this ethics lecture. But first, let's look at the numbers. And the numbers are a little bit on the oddball side. You had the Asian markets on the other side of the world. They had a very quiet day, and that was true across the world. It's been nothing really exciting. The Nikkei actually finished up a little bit, less than 0.5%, but still it's up for the day. And Hang Seng was similar, that it was up about a little more, almost 0.3%, but it kind of was sliding through the day. There's kind of a malaise right now, wait and see what's going to happen all over the world. In Europe, you can see some negative, well, a lot of negative, especially on the continent. The CAC 40 just was not in good shape at all today. Euronext, I didn't look at Euronext. It was down too. So Europe is kind of suffering a little bit of a brutal day today. But FTSE, it was trying to stay up, but by the end it had taken a nosedive too. Over on our side, the Dow was down through the day, and it was sliding, and then it began to crawl back up. We're still not, the day isn't over yet, but it's crawling back up. And I think it's still a negative, but it's coming back up. It's not going to be a spectacular day one way or the other. The S&P 500 has had a pretty strong day, because earnings reports are coming out, and some of them are maybe not terribly good, but they're better than the investors were expecting. So better than negative is anything to celebrate right now, because there's a lot of concerns about companies starting to lose money because of the conflict in the Middle East. But we're still seeing decent earnings, so we're seeing a lot of positive stock price movements, and so the S&P is up, and the NASDAQ was up too, and it was up rather, the NASDAQ has actually surged just in the last couple of hours. So there you are, we got a good show there. We go down here, oil has calmed down a lot, and that's good news. How long it'll stay good news is kind of speculative, but we're definitely below $100 a barrel. I'm trying to see, where is, oh, there it is. Yeah, they're both below $100 a barrel. And that's going to be good news because that'll bring down gas prices. They'll come back down into maybe the $3.79 area, and that's, you know, better than it was when we were at $4.29. But that won't happen right away. It takes a while for those oil prices going down to cause gasoline prices to respond downward. Now, on the other side here, I did want to point out that the 10-year Treasury bond is down a little bit. It was staying about above 4.31, something like that. So it's shaved off 4 basis points right now. It's still unusually high, and it's not very good for the economy for the interest rates to be that high, but at least we've got a little bit of movement downward for the day anyway. just a look at a couple of quick numbers here. Like I said, earnings, this is another time when earnings are coming out, reports of earnings. And if you wanted to have a look, a couple, look, okay, PNC. Now, PNC is, of course, a ginormous bank, and see how they're doing. And look at that, real strong day upward. Now, interestingly, look at that rodeo ride it did over the day. It's one of those, there was rumors that it would come out bad earnings, then the rumors were kind of thwarted, and finally confirmed good, strong earnings. And so you're up over 1.33% for the day. And the banking stocks in general are showing good, strong earnings. So this was definitely one of those rodeo rides. It really moved around a lot. Let me take you out of that sector, and I'm going to do earnings that came out. I think they've come out. J.B. Hunt, and you probably are familiar. It's a giant trucking company. J.B. Oh, it took a hit. Wow. Bad earnings, and it just smacked down, and it stayed down too. So that must have, I didn't look at the earnings, actually the earnings report. I heard it was going to be bad, but that is really a bad smack that JB did. Look at that, down almost 2%, and it's still sliding downward. So that's just a kind of a one of those things where the transportation, across road transportation, the companies that do that are already experiencing the higher diesel prices, which are just sucking away profits. And it's just not a good situation for transportation stocks right now in general, with those high prices that were here through the first quarter of of this year. And so it would just simply punish terribly. Sell-off was pretty dramatic on that one. It may, I'm almost interested next week, if I remember, I'll show it to you again. I kind of suspect that it will recover some of that loss over the next few days of trading, because that looks like a really strong, perhaps overreaction to a bad earnings report. But we'll just have to wait and see about that one. So there you are for the stocks. And again, as I just getting toward the final, make sure that you have your understanding of beta, price earnings ratio, what it means for the company to pay dividends. And it means that you, an investor, can make money off the stock going up, and also from a dividend check. So those are two different ways that you can make money. And then, of course, I will expect you to know what bid and ask are. Just give you, you a warning about what's coming. Now, Quiz 7 is specific to the lectures of a couple of weeks ago, but the final quiz and the final exam will be much more comprehensive. So make sure that you're getting your studying done early for those big ones that are coming up. Now, let me take you into the lecture today. Now, first of all, in your files folder, on the top level of files in Canvas, you will see that there is a PowerPoint presentation called Agency. That covers a pretty big chunk of what I'm going to teach you about today. Is the idea of agency in the context of ethics. Let me start this with, first of all, the state of Illinois encourages, in fact, almost requires that courses cover the topic of ethics. Now, we all know that Illinois is the most ethical of all states as far as governance goes. And I mean that completely sarcastically. Illinois is the most corrupt nation, state in the nation, or at least it's up there near the top. But by golly, every year I have to take an ethics course. And every year I have to do that to make sure I'm ethical. Our teaching assistant has to take that same ethics course. Are you ethical now? Good, good. See, that training teaches us how to be ethical. Actually, it doesn't. Because there is this mistaken idea, it is rampant, it is pervasive, that if you know the laws about behaving yourself, then that is the same as knowing ethics. They are not the same. Just because I follow the law does not mean that I am acting ethically. Let me break this down for you in sort of a four-way block. On the top, I'll write legal versus not legal. And on the side here, I will put in ethical, unethical. Now, we use the terms ethical and unethical as a secular way of expressing right, wrong, moral, immoral. We avoid right and wrong, especially we avoid using terms like moral and immoral, because those carry a religious valence to them. And we live in a secular society. And in just a minute, I'll be talking about when that secularism began to decouple from the religious. And it happened hundreds of years ago. And then we started having to talk about how we could frame ethical, rightful action without invoking a religious book to do it. And that was what started to happen in the 1600s, and in the 1700s, it took up a lot more muscle. The idea of ethics without discussing something religious telling us to be that way. What was a rational foundation for ethical action? Now, in that right there, legal versus illegal, ethical versus unethical, there are actions which are obviously both legal and right to do. Many things. It's right to obey the speed limit. It's also ethical. It's also legal. That's a legal action. However, there are actions that are not legal, but they are ethical. And you pay a terrible price sometimes for acting in a way that is the right thing to do, but it's not the legal thing to do. Whistleblowers end up getting prosecuted as well as sued. They get prosecuted for doing the things they do. I'll give you just one of just tens of thousands of examples from the time of the Iraq War. There was a CIA employee, her name was rather odd, it was Reality Winner, who was had security clearance. She was going through files, and she found a file that had a clip from a CCTV camera. There was a group walking down a street in Baghdad, and two of the men were carrying weapons. And there were obviously women and children in this group, and from somewhere else, most likely the gun camera itself, they were all killed, slaughtered, right there on the street. Well, it turned out that those two people with the weapons were security guards protecting the family as it went from one place to another. We did it, and we declared the video top secret, and told the families that their family members were killed by insurgents. Well, she knew better than that, and so she told everyone. She brought it out. She exposed them. She released a pile of top secret files, and this video was in there. And she was prosecuted and sent to prison for years for what she did, because she acted against the, what her action was illegal. But it was also ethical and right in her mind that those families should know what really happened to their loved ones. So there, and this will happen in the corporate world. A company will commit actions, and or the company, by law, you can't tell what the company did, especially for companies that work for the government, but they were the right thing to do. And you will face that in your careers. A number of you will, with some companies that do things that are legal, but they are absolutely unethical to do them. On the other hand, there are actions that are legal, but they are unethical to carry out. You're allowed to do these things. Did you know, sir, that in your cereal there is rat poop? Did you know that? It's legal, because in the giant silos, in those big grain cars, they can't have rats. Lots and lots of rats. And the rats take their dumps in the grain, and then it's processed and ground up. And so you're, as Tony Tiger would say, it's not just they're great, they're also their shit, because they have that nasty stuff. However, it is legal under FDA regulations to have a certain amount of turd in your cereal. It's just legal. It's okay. It is legal for these companies that do GMOs, and it's legal for them to use those glyphosates on the crops, because they work and they do good for the overall society, but they are also causing damage to people when they are there. And then there are, of course, unethical, illegal actions as well. And there are very few who would argue that there's any issue there. If it's wrong and it's against the law, well, absolutely, we cannot argue with that. However, the thing, though, is that we need a framework of ethics for business. And in its context, in the society itself, obviously, a business doesn't exist in a vacuum. But we can't just say, well, let's be ethical, or we're an ethical company. It has to be baked into the actual framework of the company for it to be meaningful. But therein lies the discussion. How do we define ethical action? And we, without invoking some kind of religious book to do it. Because, first of all, we're not all of the same religion, and we are, even within a religion, there are so many variations that we can't just say, well, they say, well, what if this sect says that it's okay? Then we have to avoid that. We need something that is comprehensive, and it is usable, and it is scalable from the smallest company up to the largest company. The first attempt at this, this was in the sort of like the Age of Enlightenment, there was this strong effort to pull the civil society away from religious framework. Places where you saw it was when in the witch trials were all about religious obedience and all that. You began to see more enlightened, educated governance in the colonies and in Europe saying, don't burn people at the stake, and it began to take hold. We don't do that kind of stuff. and it sort of began to be pervasive in more and more areas of life, that we have to have good reasons for what we do. And those good reasons have to be to good ends, what we do. In that framework, there was a philosopher some centuries ago. His name was Immanuel Kant. And he laid out what might be considered the first authoritative secular directive for ethical action. It was called the categorical imperative. And it worked like this. Always act as you would expect others to act. Always act as you would expect others to act. Now, this sounds like the golden rule, but it is not. You know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. This does not talk about you. You are the do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Okay? That's not good enough. Because this has to do with how you act in general. And what you do doesn't center on what could happen to you. It is what should be done overall. If I expect myself to do things right, then I should expect that of others. Whether or not it affects me what they do, we always act, and it's personal. I'm not telling you that I want you to act this way. I'm telling myself that I act this way because I expect others to act this way. That means that you have to have a foundation within yourself of rightful action. It puts the expectation on you, but the expectation doesn't have any reference to what will happen back to you. It is, everyone should do this. And if we all did this, if we always acted as we would expect everyone else to act, then everyone would act in an ethical, rightful way. It's called categorical. Because it is always. There isn't any situation involved in it. It's always. You live by a code, by a core of convictions, not by a code of conduct. Always. And then it's an imperative because you don't get wiggle room. If this is what you want, you expect others, then it's based upon what you expect of yourself. Don't be a hypocrite and say, well, they should do it, but I don't need to. Now, this was the first framework, and it was strong and it was enduring. And it carried us a long ways in thinking about rightful action without reference to, well, God says, or this prophet says, or this holy man says. It doesn't even have anything to do with what, actually, it doesn't really even have anything to do with what the society says. A society can be very corrupt. It can be downright monstrous. But that doesn't matter. You act as you would expect others to act. The problem is that it is rigid. It has no flexibility whatsoever. And so by the 19th century, the 1800s, we began to see philosophers stepping in another direction. Less away from categorical and more towards situational ethics. Now, the situational ethics takes a couple of different paths. The one that is, there is a kind of rigid one, and then there is a more open one. And I focus on the one that is the most common to this day, and it is actually pervasive. It's called utilitarianism. Utilitarianism. Now, it was first championed by a philosopher named John Stuart Mill. You don't need to know that part, but you do need to know utilitarianism. Its position was situational. You act for the greatest good for the greatest number. This is the basis of democracy. And the majority rules. And that is situational because the majority may change or whatever. But it is the guiding principle of much action. So that the FDA can say there is allowed a certain minimal amount of rat feces in grain. There is a certain amount of toxicity that crop pesticides can have. There's a certain amount of unknown risk in genetically modified organisms. Nevertheless, in all of those situations, the greatest good for the greatest number is by allowing these things to be used, to happen, whatever. The problem with this is quite obvious, though. The greatest good for the greatest number meant that slavery was A-OK, because only a minority of human beings were in slavery. The greatest good for the greatest number would allow for the discrimination against the disabled, would allow for the discrimination against minorities. That would be all okay in utilitarianism, because the greatest good was being experienced by the greatest number of people. That is a problem. However, again, utilitarianism works because it does advance the social fabric in its own way. But let me take an example. Let me do one that would be perhaps a bit of a challenge in this regard. Madam, you are the president of a big, huge company. You're the CEO, the president. You, in fact, it's a pharmaceutical company. And you have developed a drug that cures a childhood illness. This childhood illness, once a child contracts it, dies within 2 years. And your clinical trials have gone through. You have found that this drug works. In 999 of every 1,000 afflicted children. So you are in your office the night before the big announcement. You're going to do a press conference and cameras are flashing. This is going to cause your stock price, the price of the stock of your pharmaceutical company, to go through the roof. Now remember, your only duty is maximizing the wealth of your shareholders. That is your only duty. Well, you're getting ready to pack up the evening before, you're really excited, and I come in. I'm the chief scientist. You know, here's the thing. You know that one child in 999? Once he takes the drug, he dies in 6 weeks. If he didn't take the drug, he'd live 2 years, but he dies in 6 weeks. Now, you have to go before that press conference tomorrow morning. You know the stakes for the stock price. And you know that your job is to maximize those shareholders' wealth. What are you going to do? You're going to be transparent. Yeah. And in fact, you'll probably lose your job. Yeah. Exactly. That's the point. I'm glad you said it that way. The consequences upon you personally are nearly catastrophic. No one's going to hire her. Oh my God, she tells the truth. You know, F that. I'm not going to hire you. So what would you do, madam, in a situation like this? Yes. Yes.
I would just present to the stockholders, but it's not.
To what? What would you say?
I would say that in this trial, 999 of the 1,000 got to have that illness cured. I don't think I would mention.
Very good. Okay. You know, screw that kid. What happens if it's your child, though? Oh, ouch.
Well, the thing is,
go ahead.
I say it like this, but if the kid only has 2 years, so it's not like this could possibly be something where you could live and it wouldn't affect you. You would never die from it. This child's going to die in 2 years. I would rather take the possibility of giving them something that could save their life.
In other words, you're working, yeah, and that is actually that would be the utilitarian view. And that is the view that it would be taken by the rational agent in a situation like this. Absolutely. But the problem, of course, is that one child who could have experienced 2 years of sunlight and laughter and, you know, living itself will die in 6 weeks. And so there is that pain. And every last one of you, I'm pretty sure, will face ethical dilemmas like this. You will work for corporations that make lots of money, and some people die because of that. This auditorium is named after a company that makes a lot of great things, but it also makes engines that destroy humans at the same time. But not many, not the majority. So there's the utilitarian aspect going on. And so they proceed as they are, and you working for them will advance that utilitarian ethic. And there, don't get me wrong, this is what we use and it works. However, it can also lead to dire consequences. Hence, there is another version of this which says it has to be a case-by-case basis. Which, of course, allows for more fine-tuning of your ethical action decision. The problem with that is that that means that every time you face a dilemma, you've got to sit and think about it for a while. And unfortunately, that is not an option. Corporations don't spend their time contemplating their belly buttons, thinking about ethical versus unethical. They have to move quickly because there is competition that will eat them alive if they don't take action. Let me take this off the board. We have a way in business of pushing this aside and reframing the entire discussion. And it requires just a couple of definitions, and they're important for you to remember. I want you to do your attendance radar right now so we can get that out of the way before I start the rant. Here we go. A little sentence for definition. An agent is a person charged with maximizing the welfare of another person called the principal. That's PAL. Here, and now it's important that I emphasize a word I've used in here. The word person right here, and then down here. In law, a person could be an individual, but it also could be a group, a definable group, a legal group. So the body of the shareholders is a person. A partnership is a person. Contracts establish oftentimes a person. The corporation is a person under the law. So this definition of agent and principal carries the weight of a large number of entities, individuals and collections of individuals. And it also carries the weight of individuals, not in every situation, but in specific situations. They could be a person other than just the individual. So keep that in mind as I take you forward in this. But remember, and I'm going to try a few examples with you of this. For example, a doctor is an agent of the patient, because the doctor is charged with maximizing the health of the patient. A citizen a soldier, let's say, is an agent of a person called the Constitution. Let's try a couple on you. Since you are a thinking kind of individual, a child and a parent, who is the agent and who is the principal?
The agent is
the parent. Exactly. A child is a principal because it's the parent who is charged with maximizing the welfare of the child. That's an excellent one right there. Let's try now another one. The board of directors as a body is the agent of the shareholders because it is the board of directors' duty to maximize the wealth of the shareholders. Let me try another one. You, sir, I'll try this one. A husband and a wife. Who is the agent and who is the principal? And I caution you to be careful in how you answer that. No, there's no depends. We're not talking diapers for old people. What do you say? Here's the surprise. The husband and the wife are both the agents of the marriage contract because it is their joint and several duty to maximize the marriage. So the marriage is the principle. The principle doesn't have to be a human. It can be a contract. That's the thing that you elevate above the common person thinking framework. And that's what your education here does. It elevates you to think in more complex terms about a lot of different subjects, and you've already found that out. And in this one, we have to think about agency in a new framework, a legal framework. So here's the thing, though. There's a problem here that you see how I'm beginning to create a framework of positive action by framing two different identifiably separate groups in any relationship, and especially we're applying this to the business relationship. But here is the problem. Well, okay. This is called the agency dilemma. This is the core of it. And this is where we have to reframe what we consider to be rightful action, ethical action. The agent has incentive to maximize its own welfare instead of that of the principal. That's not saying that they will, but they always, always have an incentive to maximize their own welfare instead of the principal's welfare. I'll give you an example, parent-child relationship. I am a parent. I come dragging home. I'm exhausted from teaching all day, working for many long hours. I go into the house and there are the kids and they're tearing up the place. One kid's swinging from the overhead lamp and another kid's drawing all over the walls and one's bouncing up and down on the couch. And I you know what I'm going to do? I'm supposed to just grab them and hug them and say, oh, let's go. I'm going to make you a perfect meal from scratch. And then we're going to give you baths and I'm going to read you bookies before bed. I love you so much. You know what I'm going to do instead? I'm going to just try. Oh, stop it. Damn it. You get it here. Take my bow. Beat yourself with it. You see, you have an incentive to maximize your own welfare. Let me try back with you. You're a married man now. Your wife is out of town on a business trip for the whole week. You've been out of college for a few years and you're kind of getting bored with life. And the phone rings. Ring, ring. Hello. And hi. I don't know if you remember me. I'm with the sorority that you used to be in. I'm still with it. And we're having a twerkathon and we'd like to have you be the judge. Now remember, you're married. What are you going to say? Come on. Your man card is on the line here, brah. You know damn well you want to go there and judge. But you know that you're charged with maximizing the welfare of that marriage. So you see the dilemma there? Okay, that's what I'm talking about. It's these incentives of the agent to maximize his or her own welfare instead of that of the principles. You see how this is now beginning to frame itself. What is rightful action to do? First of all, you have to understand something. Anything you do to abate this is only as good as the monitoring and enforcement of the contract. If you can monitor it but you can't enforce, you got nothing. If you can enforce but you can't monitor as a principal, you got nothing. I can say, I'm watching you. I don't want you using your phones between your legs to do have a ChatGPT get your test done. I'm going to watch you. But if I don't do anything, it doesn't matter. You're still going to do it. You're still going to pursue your own maximization, welfare maximization. Or if I do it the other way, by God, if you cheat, I'll spank you and I'll pinch your butt and I'll criticize you heavily. But if I'm just sitting up here on my fat ass, you're not going to do a damn thing about it. Lol, there he is on his fat ass. Quick, what's the answer, Mr. ChatGPT? You understand you have to have both monitoring and enforcement. Now notice I'm talking about the principle here. Here's the thing. The principle is responsible for the monitoring and enforcement. The agent is going to act in his or her own self-interest. You have to assume that. I don't care if you are a fine, upstanding young stud who never does anything wrong, I'm still going to assume that you will maximize your own welfare instead of mine. I'm the boss, but I have to assume that you will do it. Now you're saying, well, that makes us all feel so down and dirty. Yeah. But I guarantee you that that is how you can keep the relationship working and get what needs to be done for me, the principal. Now I'm going to bring up something here. The principal is responsible because of the ancient doctrine of vicarious liability. It's the principal's job to monitor and enforce, not the agent's job. The term that's also, the principal is called the respondeat superior. Respondeat superior. Not the agent, the principal is responsible. Give you an example of this. You can't, in other words, you can't just blame the agent. Well, the agent did this. It's not, yeah, it is yours. That's why the principal needs to focus on monitoring and enforcement. This is the way that you maintain the ethical action. Not through hope, not through love and caring and pretending and imagining a better time. It's through rigorous monitoring and enforcing. I'll give you an example. Now, you can tell by that this is going to go south pretty quick. Because one, this happened in West Virginia. That should clue you something bad's going to happen. Two, it happened in a bar in West Virginia. There's two. And three, it involves knives. There was a bar long ago near a town in West Virginia where one of the bartenders was incredible at throwing knives, bowie knives. He could nail a card across a room and it was there. He had a true talent for it. Well, one night while the bar was pretty busy, this old timer who was hung around the bar a lot was just walking through and he walked right in the path of a knife that the bartender had thrown. He turned just in time to have the knife go through his left eye. He was drunk enough that he didn't feel it too much. He just went to the emergency room at the local hospital. He walked around in there until he found a nurse, and he said, "Ask me if this hurts." She took one look at this 5-inch knife sticking out of his face, and she went to a happy place. But he lived through it, and he sued the owners of the bar, the principals. And the owners of the bar said, "Oh, no, you don't sue us. He did that. He, our bartender, sue him." Absolutely not. The court threw out that defense, said it is the vicarious liability falls upon the principals. You were supposed to monitor and enforce, and especially the fact that you knew he threw knives and you knew that that was doing good, making your business better because more people came in because he was there doing this neat thing that he did. So no, you don't get off the hook this way. Now, this is related to another concept here. And this one has to do with liability as well. It happened at a used car dealership in the Midwest. If I remember the case, it was here in Illinois somewhere. But anyway, now, used car salesmen, they buy their cars from brokers, used car brokers. And that's how these places get their cars all the time around town, the used car places. Okay, now in this case, there was a little old lady, literally. She went to this used car dealership, and there was this nice-looking older car, but it had just 12,000 miles on it. It was a cream puff of a car. And so she bought that car, and she drove it away. About 2 weeks later, the car just fell apart. The engine just went shot. And so she had it towed to a local mechanic, a garage, and he said, "I'll tell you right now, this car's got easily 200,000 miles on it." "Well, but this title, it says 12,000, and he told me 12,000. No, the odometer box, this was when they had the dial once, it's been jimmied. This car's got 200,000 if it has 1 mile on it. And so she sued the dealership, and the used car dealership said, "Oh, we're not responsible for this because we bought it from the broker with a 12,000 mile title on it. So don't blame us, blame someone else." That defense was thrown out, and here's why. It is the distinction between actual and constructive knowledge. Actual knowledge is what you do know. Constructive knowledge is what you could know based upon your representations, your experience, and your training, and a few other things. He had posed as an expert in used cars. He sold them. He had sold them for a long time. It's not that he did know that the odometer had been jimmied. It was that he could have known. And that is the threshold for liability. Make sure you understand that. It's not what you do know. It's what you could know based upon what you represent of yourself and what your background is. So always keep that one in mind. Now, back to the center of this. In my world, in finance, and you've heard me say this before, we always want to say, "How much is it?" You know, if you wanted to be my friend, I'd want to know how much money this is going to make me. In finance, we're very cold that way. I don't care if this is a great product. How much is it worth? So when we talk about agency, we need to talk about agency costs. What is agency action, maximizing its own welfare, costing us? We break it down into 5 categories. The first of those agency costs is shirking. I'm sorry, perquisites. Perquisites. What we call perks. This is the CEO who has a giant desk and a big, soft, excellent leather chair. That's a perk. A perquisite is a benefit drawn by status of agency. A perquisite is a benefit that is drawn by status of agency. That CEO, that's the shareholder's money he spent for that desk. A long time ago, I was offered a job as a comptroller of a corporation. And they, you're making so little as a professor. Why don't you just, come with us? And I said, you don't want me because you've got a private jet. You fly your executives to all these places for meetings. I would have you going on Greyhound because that private jet, the fuel, the maintenance, the storage and all that, the pilots, that is shareholders' money. And you are supposed to be the agents of that, of those shareholders. The same is true with a lot of other perks, these things that you take by virtue of being able to as an agent. You shouldn't, you're taking the shareholders' money. That's not yours. And so that is an agency cost. The next one is shirking. Shirking is avoiding your duties. Walking around other people's cubicles and chatting with them, having a nice talk about how the weekend went, how the kids are doing, and all that kind of stuff. That's shirking your responsibility. Famous story, I was at a dinner one night with the executives of a corporation. Well, they were upper level, they weren't the C-suite. But one of them said, my desk is clear every night when I go home. And there was this administrative assistant who was at it, and she leaned over to me and she said, that's because when he has everyone else leave and then he takes the work on his desk and he puts it on theirs, on his subordinates. So they come in the morning thinking their desks are clear and there's this pile of work he's put on their desks. That's shirking. Shirking is the extra few minutes for your smoke break. Shirking is doing, I was at a store just a couple of weeks ago. I swear to God, that cashier, I had five items and he was blip. And then a few minutes later, blip, he was shirking his duties. He was going so slow, I almost lost my crap on him. Will you hurry up, for God's sake? I don't have that many years left to live. Okay, that's shirking. Now, the next one is lying. Surprisingly, not that uncommon. Have you gotten that report done? Oh yeah, I'm working on it. I'll be done by tomorrow with that. Yeah, I'm right there with it. Yeah. Bullshit, you haven't even started. Like that Excel sheet, that Excel certification had 9 weeks and the night before you were getting it done, but that's not the same thing quite. But the point is, lying is not that uncommon. We are shocked when politicians lie. That is cultural norm. Now, lying in and of itself, you cannot end lying. That does not mean that it is not an agency cost. Lying about in academia is lying in businesses. It's just there. However, it is an agency cost because it diverts attention and resources away from the facts of a situation. It bends our decision making toward things that aren't quite true. Exaggerations or just nuances of numbers, not looking at all of the parameters, knowing very well that there were things that you did not look at. That's a form of lying too, just so you can bias a decision toward your own interests. Now, this next one is just direct theft, stealing. You're just stealing. It happens. I see one notebook up in the cabinet upstairs, but there's 10 there, so, I need one, but, there's 10. Who's going to notice? No, I don't do that. Swear to God. But stealing, just, taking something, you work at a store and you grab something you really like and taking it home with you. That's kind of common. Well, actually, it's very, very common. I shouldn't say that. Stealing is just, is a part of business. It happens to the extent that the principal does not monitor and enforce. If you have enough monitoring and sufficient enforcement, that agency cost would not be there. That's what I mean by this whole thing about the principals can bitch all they want, but they're the ones who are responsible for making sure that the agency cost is not extracted. Now, the fifth one, and I begin this by asking, have you ever worked in a company where you had a coworker who was as dumb as a box of rocks? And that's disrespecting rocks. Yeah, some of you have. This one is incompetence. Now, this is actually the subject of a management principle. It's actually a management principle. It was developed decades and decades ago by a Professor Peters, and there was a book. It was called The Peter Principle. It goes like this. Every employee is rising to his or her level of incompetence. Every employee is rising to his or her level of incompetence. And when that person reaches that level of incompetence, that person stays there. So whenever you look into a room full of employees, every one of them is on the path to or has arrived at his or her level of incompetence. I want you to think about it this way. Who should I buy over here? You, madam. You were hired as an entry-level data entry operator. Put data into Excel. Well, it turns out that you are awfully good at that. You're like an animal. Moving data in, moving the look at table. Okay, this should go in this column. I mean, you're awesome. So in a meritocratic organization, you're going to get promoted. And so you are. And in this new position, you're still incredible. You're awesome. You're wild. And so you get promoted again, this time to a manager of data for the corporation. And there you're still yourself an incredible person, a great employee. So you go up just below the C-suite and you're still good at what you do. I mean, you're just amazing. And then one day into the office, you're hearing all this music on the overhead and then the music changes. Instead of some silly music, the music says, ba 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 ba, and you realize that the chief executive officer of the whole corporation, Mr. Darth Vader, is coming in and he's walking right toward your desk, and he looks right at you and he stands there with his black robes and he says, "You have succeeded where others have failed. I am now inviting you to become the chief financial officer of this corporation." You know damn well you can't do that. You know you can't do that. "We will offer you $500,000 a year in salary. You will have your own car and your own budget, and you will have the keys to the executive toilets. Together we can rule the galaxy. Join me or die." What are you going to say? No or yes? Of course you are. She rose to her level of incompetence. Every one of you. You'll take the promotions. Of course you will. You're not stupid. Fake it until you make it. Except it'll always be fake it. You'll keep going up until you stop. That's where a lot of the CEOs and football coaches, basketball coaches, presidents of universities, professors, shut up. You understand? That's where we are all headed. Because you're not going to say no when you rise, and that was the Peter principle. It's not a theory, it's just a logical reality. And so that's an agency cost. And together, you put these together, this is a lot of cost that is hidden within a corporate structure. And how do we say, well, what's the ethical thing to do? Monitoring and enforcement. You assume the worst, and I mean, maybe you actually do come through. No, you won't. But you understand what's happened here is that we have categorized what the costs are of the agency dilemma. And we have found a framework that dispenses with ethics altogether. It is business. And business requires cold-blooded thinking with respect to performance. And it's not a soft world out there. It's going to be brutal for you guys, even more so because AI is going to take it out of your hide, watch you every step, everywhere you go. But the reality is that it's always been moving toward this. Finding a framework where you don't have to ask questions about ethical action. You know what you have to do, and ethics is not an issue, not a problem in this way of doing things. We maximize welfare of the society best through maximizing the efficiency of the entities that produce the goods and services of it. And how do you do that? You treat the agency dilemma as the challenge that you accept through monitoring and enforcement. There's only one part left in this story. It goes back to the core of the agency dilemma. Remember that the principal is responsible for monitoring and enforcing the performance of the agents. But what happens when the principal cannot do that? Think about the parent-child relationship. The parent is the agent. The child is responding at superior. It's a responsibility of the child to watch the parent, monitor and enforce. But the kid can't do that. The kid doesn't know what's right and wrong. Another one, a doctor is the agent of the patient. But what if you're under anesthesia? You don't know what that doctor's doing. You can't monitor and enforce. A lawyer is the agent of a client, the principal. And that means, but you don't know the law. You can't walk into a courtroom and mount a serious defense against a lawyer or a government agency. There are many times, not every time, but there are many times when you cannot say that the principal is respondeat superior. In those matter of fact, the shareholders of a corporation really can't monitor and enforce the behavior of the board of directors, the C-suite people. They can't do it. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about a special agency relationship. It's called fiduciary. Now, Black's Law Dictionary, the Bible of law, calls this the highest duty implied by law. It is a duty of an agent whose principal cannot monitor and enforce. The agent has to act autonomously to behave, to do what's right for the principal, because the principal simply cannot, for one reason or another, monitor and enforce. Fiduciary duty has three pillars: trust, loyalty, and fidelity. Fidelity is faithfulness. The code of the knights of the round table, as it were. This is, you can enshrine this in law, and there are all laws at the state and federal level that simply say, this is a fiduciary duty. It goes deeper than that. When the Black's Law Dictionary says it is the highest duty implied by law, that definition says this goes back behind law to the ancient tribal law of the times far, far in the past. It's more than just some politicians writing, you have fiduciary duty. It goes deeper than that. And that's one of the things that has failed in modern education, in higher education. I'll bet you haven't been told about fiduciary duty in this way ever before. And yet this is so timeless, we can find it in before written languages. We hear it in the whispers of the words in the connected languages around the Indo-European area. The same sounding words, lex, ligature, logos, line. In other words, bindings of people through fiduciary duties, where there is an interdependence. And the fiduciary duty is the highest duty implied by law, which means that you've got a problem if you are in more than one fiduciary relationship. There is no highest of the highest. They are both the highest. And if they begin to conflict with each other, like a parent-child relationship and your duty as an agent of shareholders, they're both the highest. How do you reconcile those? Well, you don't, because you can't prioritize them. So you have to begin to make decisions about which one are you going to violate today? Which fiduciary duty are you not going to carry out when you come home late from work? Or which fiduciary duty are you not carrying out if you decide you're going to take your kids to a park instead of go to work? One way or the other, you're going to break one of them. The highest duty, you'll have to choose which one you are going to breach. So keep that in mind when you think about fiduciary duty. And that's all I have for you. I thank you.